This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was the president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League, celebrating 100 years of existence. Sherry Runner is the president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League. The Urban League founded 101 years ago to help provide migrants to the city of Chicago from the American South with jobs, new opportunities, educational opportunities, and a better life. Sherry said, in some ways, we haven't come very far from the Kerner Report of 50 years ago. We still have two cities in the city of Chicago. Things on the west and south sides, she said, are getting worse, not better. There are complex challenges that face us with no easy solution. Sherry Runner talked about problems in education, especially among African-American males. 37% of African-American males fail to graduate from high school, compared to 22% of the general population. Schools in black areas, she said, are underfunded, underperforming, under-enrolled, and being closed. The area of jobs, disproportionately high unemployment among African-Americans. 19.5% of the 17 and older residents on the west side are unemployed. In Englewood, that number reaches 37%. Problems with law enforcement. Instead of serving and protecting large areas of the African-American community, see increased drug use, drug policies that fuel mass incarceration, illegal guns flooding certain areas that foster crime, violence, and trauma. The lack of trust is a key problem. She talked about the need for strategic, comprehensive solutions and not panic-driven reactions. She concluded by challenging people, saying solving the problems will not be easy or cheap. We must hold our politicians to the fire and demand strong economic investment. We have many problems. We have many biases. She said we must confront these areas one at a time with resolve and determination. There will be no quick solutions.
So about halfway down here from my house in Hyde Park, I had planned to bring a black beret and a pair of Ray-Bans to sit on the podium, and I realized that I had left them at home. And so the words that I said are not really appropriate for the City Club today, but I just want to let you know sort of that's where we're going, not all the way there. I want to dedicate the remarks that I'm about to make to the Kerner Report, whose 50th anniversary and release would be on the 29th, but since this isn't a leap year, it will be Thursday of this year, and we should all be quite aware of the meaningfulness of that and what that means to all of us in this room. I want to thank you for that introduction, Jackie Robinson Ivey, my good girlfriend, who always sends me pictures of Bruno Mars, who is my absolute favorite, and for the City Club for having me here today. It's a privilege to be with people who I know are as concerned about this city as I am. The Chicago Urban League was founded 101 years ago. As the dawn of the Great Migration brought thousands of African Americans from the rural South to Chicago, a city filled with the promise of jobs, new opportunities, and a better life. The League's importance grew and has endured because of support and cooperation from many organizations, institutions, and private citizens that have helped make Chicago a great city, and in fact, a world-class city. I am honored to serve as the League's president and CEO as we enter into this, our second century. I came to share with you today a radical notion. Radical because the Chicago Urban League is advocating for thorough and complete political and social change. However, I must admit that as I stand here ready to engage, I also struggle. I struggle because it should not be radical. I struggle because this conversation we're about to have should have been difficult in 1960, but not today. I struggle because after Barack Obama's election, when we were supposed to be post-racial, some of the people I grew up with in my liberal enclave of Hyde Park, who are now part of the conservative elite, tell me that I must accept that the proliferation of illegal guns, in our streets is a cultural inevitability, that I must accept that the rich receive tax cuts and feel joy as their 401ks and investments grow exponentially, while poor people bear the burdens of scarcity and survival. They tell me that the formerly incarcerated are alone culpable for their fate. But I know the truth, and I'm a radical, and I demand a radical solution. So here is my radical idea. I want for African Americans here in Chicago, a world-class city, the promise of America, to be truly considered equal to any other citizen with a real opportunity for quality education, good jobs, and affordable, accessible housing and stable communities. The very things that made Chicago the destination of choice during the Great Migration. While that hardly seems radical, the resistance that has long been met by those of us who advocate for these basics suggests that it is. It certainly was in the late 1960s, when advocating for equality cost 21-year-old Fred Hampton his life and has cost the lives of countless African Americans since then. In this current environment, I must note that a Black Panther was not always a fictional superhero with a movie that is grossing hundreds of millions of dollars. But it is interesting to ponder whether Stan Lee and Huey P. Newton were reading the same things in 1966 to build this strong Black image. Right now, the need to be radical is urgent. It is just as urgent now as it was in the 60s, and perhaps more so. So I am the new radical. Humbly, I am Angela Davis, I'm Fred Hampton, I'm Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, standing before you, screaming for change and not accepting anything less. We speak often of, and it is widely understood, that there are two Chicagos. There is the Chicago that boasts that it has the best educated workforce in any big city in America, that it has some of the best public schools in the nation, and that its city center is thriving. Then there is the other Chicago, or more candidly, the Black and brown Chicago, the racially concentrated areas of poverty where the workforce picture shows staggering unemployment rates. For African Americans, as high as 19.5% in North Lawndale on the west side and 35.9% in Inglewood on the south side. In the other Chicago, too many public high schools and are not only underperforming, but their environments are unfit for effective learning, whether it be because they have outdated textbooks or limited technology, or because they simply are run down and infested with vermin, as was the case with just a few months ago at Mollison Elementary School in Bronzeville. While the city's high school graduation rates have improved in recent years, too many students remain behind. According to Chicago Public Schools, roughly 37% of African American boys fail to graduate within 5 years, compared to 22% of the general population, and that is not great. In this other Chicago, predominantly African American neighborhoods on the south and west sides have been devastated by decades of economic disinvestment, poverty, and mass incarceration. The other Chicago is where gun violence claims hundreds of lives each year, potential is lost, and it is accepted as normal. This other Chicago is the place that many African Americans have been fleeing to pursue opportunities elsewhere. No doubt, many of them descendants of those who saw Chicago as full promise and opportunity during the Great Migration. In 2016, more than 12,000 African Americans moved out of Cook County. Chicago's Black population has fallen by more than 240,000 since the year 2000. I understand why so many Black families have left or are preparing to leave. As part of the centennial, we relaunched our research and policy department, and part of that work is our race and equity initiative. We've talked to parents, students, and other community members, and many of them have told us that they remained committed to their neighborhoods for as long as they could, After all, many of the South and West Side neighborhoods that are so challenged today were once meccas of black life. Long before Sears Roebuck and Company made this transportation hub its home in 1893, Jean-Baptiste Point du Sable, the city's founder, had figured it out. He was the first to determine that this location, so close to the Chicago River and to Lake Michigan, were central to the nation's commerce. And so 130 years later, as the Chicago Defender called out to African Americans looking for a life away from the horrors of the Jim Crow South, and major businesses built their foundations here, Chicago grew, although separate and unequal. Our ancestors escaped Jim Crow, but they met redlining and contract buying and prejudice that systematically limited the ability to thrive and build wealth that others of different heritages achieved. Despite such challenges, those African Americans who answered the call to come to Chicago made major contributions to the local economy, to political life, to cultural life, and to the overall vibrancy of our city. They launched businesses, including Johnson Publishing and the hair care products manufacturer Johnson Products, the first black-owned business to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange. They became nationally known corporations. In 1938, Time magazine called Chicago the center of Negro business in the U.S. When Jet magazine published the images of Emmett Till that jolted the world into knowing the devastating effects of racist hatred. And then there are the politicians, Dawson, Harold, Braun, and Obama, the artists, Hansberry, Brooks, Hunt, and Waters. Chicago has always led the way in radical change. Even so, with the deindustrialization and a lack of investment, once strong black neighborhoods began to wane, and many black people felt that they had increasingly fewer reasons to stay. The families we talked to say they withstood businesses closing and available jobs leaving. They watched houses go into foreclosure and different families moving onto and then off of the block and then vacant lots appearing. Many watched as schools and businesses closed, health care became unavailable, and the basic services dwindled. They began to see more and more of the effects of scarcity and survival, most notably the drug trade and gun violence. They watched resources go to other communities while policing became the answer to the decimation in theirs. So even though they could still share stories of good times with nearby friends and family, after a while, the bad factors outweighed the good. As we consider that the South and West Side neighborhoods many African Americans are now leaving were once strong and thriving communities, we should all be asking ourselves, what can we do to make Chicago and all of Illinois a place where people will once again be attracted to stay and come and build legacies? Many youth and parents often talk about a lack of access and opportunity. And their biggest concern is, in our tradition, we want to provide our kids with good education. They want to work, they want to build a future, but the resources just aren't there. In Chicago right now, in 2018, we have a vocal segment of our community that thinks that their privilege allows them, and only them, the promises of our city. They say it in soft ways. They're called dog whistles. That black people are thugs, gangbangers, and violent. And through numerous microaggressions, they act on their implicit biases every day. But they also say it in big, loud ways, like justifying police misconduct and acting on their disdain for the inclusion of anyone of color to take part equally. And no matter how small you think this group is or who it includes, the advent of social media gives it a large, anonymous voice that chills out faceless perspective and hate speech. The impact of trolls and bots cannot and would not be as great if the underlying sentiment were not already there. Consider this. 2017 data from the Southern Poverty Law Center lists some 20 hate groups in Illinois that target people of color. The number grows to 32 when you include the full range of prejudices. One view of the vitriol that social media enables is that at least we know where people stand. But is it really better to know right now, today, that I will treat you one way and you should expect only so much because of your skin color, religion, or sexuality? Or is it finally time to do the hard work that requires meaningful thought to the consequences of our actions, to recognize the results of past policy and practice, accept responsibility, and enact real change? At the Chicago Urban League, we think it's long past time. Over the past century, the League has helped hundreds of thousands of people find housing, further their education, start a business, or get a good paying job. Racial inequity and the lack of political will to make resources available to African American communities have made the work of the League more than challenging. We can help children graduate from high school, but have they been adequately prepared in our school systems for the college and career pathways in front of them in this rapidly changing technology-driven environment? We can help youth and adults prepare for employment, but after improving their skills, can we send them to employers that will hire them into careers in growth industries or even into just jobs that will begin to help them support their families? We can give people the knowledge of how to invest in their communities, to create strong and stable places to live by purchasing a home or starting a business. But will they have access to the loans or capital they actually need to do so? While these problems are having a devastating impact on Black communities in Chicago, they are not the problem of the other Chicago alone. At their roots, they are the problem of racial justice, and they impact all of Chicago. And it will require all of us together to solve them. These are complex challenges that do not have easy solutions, but we must find solutions if we wish to improve the lives of Black families and slow the flow of population out of our city and out of our state. And we must demand more from our elected leaders. As a nonpartisan, nonprofit, the League during this election year is also working to make sure that our voters are informed and know the importance of their vote. The roles of our politicians and how legislators can impact the tough challenges some of our neighborhoods face. Since last month, we have been hosting a biweekly podcast called Dear Black Voter, focused specifically on educating voters and making sure they're not only registered, but that they get out and vote. At the state level, we recently sent out a questionnaire to all candidates for governor and attorney general asking about their positions on issues of race and equity and what they plan to do towards finding solutions. Once we have the responses, we will post them on our website. Right now, I call each of you to make sure that you are truly informed as a voter and truly committed to demanding real solutions from our elected officials, regardless of their race or political stripe. As Black History Month once again draws to a close, Black history continues year-round. We must incorporate Black Chicago into our being. We will not continue to be a world-class city if we continue to ignore the history and the role of the achievements of our Black residents. We simply cannot do the same things and pretend to expect different outcomes. We cannot become collectively hypnotized into thinking that it will change. In order for this city to truly grow again, despite the propaganda, it must be inclusive. In closing, I will share with you the words of James Baldwin. Upon the deaths of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, he said, "King's death signaled the end of civility in the civil rights movement." In 1966, Dr. King visited Chicago to start a poor people's movement. And he said, "I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hateful as I've seen in Chicago." King told reporters that day, stripping off his tie and vowing to continue demonstrating, "Yes, it's definitely a closed society, We're going to make it an open society. King knew it. We know it. It's way beyond time to fulfill that promise. When he spoke at Soldier Field that same summer, he said, "We're going to fill the jails of Chicago up, if necessary, to end the slums." I'm not sure that the current state of affairs was what he had in mind. And even after 100 years, we will continue to fight to bridge the education and wealth gaps, build strong communities with policies and practices that support families, and provide the necessities that nurture future leaders and not kill them, and to change the fear-mongering that pits people, races, and religions against each other. The saying goes, the people get the government that they want. If we want to make Chicago a truly world-class city, we will have to work together. We are going to make radical change. Thank you.
Sherry's looking at me. I was like, they're still clapping. I can't just interrupt everybody. We have a few questions. While we are waiting on some others, I did want to, I don't know if you saw that Bridget Gaynor was here from Aon with her apprentices, a program I know that you're, you know, working with her on. Could the apprentices just kind of wave their hands? That's a... part of...
And can the Impact Fellows stand up? Go Impact!
We had Impact Fellows here. Yes, I did know they were Impact Fellows. Sorry about that. I think we have a few questions, so we'll just get right into them. Start with the softball.
Okay.
Okay. Amy Panperini, she is a City Club member. Is she here? Okay. What recommendations do you have for someone to gain a better understanding of privilege?
That's a softball?
Yeah, it's a softball.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because privilege is difficult to describe that someone to someone that has it. And
say that again.
And it's so fascinating because I have a friend who is in an interracial marriage, and her daughter says that her mother, who is white, has privilege. And the mother's devastated and can't understand it. So it's taken a lot of soul-searching to figure it out. It is not easily describable, but it is knowable when you see it and when you understand it. And I think this is one of the things that we have to open up this broad conversation about without fear. It's going to be a lot of difficult conversations that we're going to have in order to understand the racism that pervades our society. And once we start to have that and put our shoulders down and figure it out, we'll all know what privilege is. It's not always white either.
I tried to tell you all. She was kind of... I've heard four speakers now talk about this to Chicago. And, you know, Jay always tells me the City Club is a public affairs forum where we can talk about anything. But when I hear a running theme like that, you've talked about the two Chicagos. Rod Sawyer talked about the two Chicagos a couple of weeks ago. City Treasurer Kurt Summers talked about the two Chicagos. And State's Attorney Kim Fox talked about the two Chicagos. I hear a running theme there. We got to do better. The Gregory Group, Susan Gregory, are you here? Okay. Family income is the most reliable predictor of academic performance. Does the country or state need a stronger social welfare system, or is there a more effective and efficient approach to achieve equity for our children?
Uh, Well, I'm going to start with this. The African-American community has always considered education as the basis of the foundation of our future, starting from Reconstruction when slaves actually became free. They absolutely knew that their children needed an education. And we have broken a lot of that foundation right now as it relates to how we express the need for and the value of education. It doesn't help that our education system in Chicago is broken and it's not necessarily providing our children with the skills that they need to succeed in the future. So it may be that right now, if you have the resources and are able to make sure that your child is availed of all the resources that are around them to succeed, that is determined by income, but it doesn't have to be. I'll leave it there.
I stand in awe of Sherry more often than she knows. Tasha Green-Cruzat. I think I might know her. She's here. Okay. Voices for Illinois Children, President. You mentioned your race equity initiative at the Urban League. How can thought leaders of color support your policy work?
Money. But participating in conversations. The most important thing about what we're talking about as it relates to race and equity is to acknowledge that we have a problem. And once we acknowledge that we have a problem and can have those conversations openly and really dig down into knowing that all of us have implicit biases, all of us have a lot of internal work to do to figure out what they are and how we interact with each other, then that's the start. And you should read everything that our race and policy, research and policy group puts out. It's thought-provoking, and then take some time to figure it out on your own. What does that mean? That's the most important thing.
I think Tasha, being a policy person, loaded that question, so thank you for asking that. Ted Manuel, are you here? Oh, he's back there. Hi. Are you a City Club member? We got to do something about that. We can't be. Or else we'll have to build. We need to build like a second deck up here so people can have some room. Jay, we got to do something about this. It's a high-class problem to have, I understand. Where should people of goodwill across the racial divide start applying pressure for constructive change?
Well, that's an easy one. I think everybody knows that the most important thing for social change is individuals. What do you do every day to make social change? How do you treat the people that you know and you're with and that work with? How do you promote them? How do you treat them? How do you preconceive them? What do you do with them? But then after that, so the big piece of what has to happen is political, and we have to hold our politicians accountable. We have to vote for them. We can't just register. We have to go to the polls if it's raining or snowing or windy or whatever is out there. We have to go. And then once they get into office, we absolutely have to call them up and say, this is unacceptable. You said you stood for this. Now, what are you doing about it?
Regina Armour from the Armour Group. Are you here, Regina? Okay. How do we get the business world and the education sector and healthcare to embrace and normalize this idea of equity that will make life better for all of us here in Chicago? Research has shown equity increases on the ROI. I don't know about that.
So I guess what you're saying is that diversity improves the bottom line for everybody's for everybody's company, and that's critical and crucial, and everybody knows that. They may not want to act on it, but innovative programs like the one that Bridget is doing now with Aon and Accenture and other big corporations that takes a look at people from not where they are right at this moment, but what they could potentially be, at recognizing that they are the outcome of our systems. And so it's important to try and marry those two and try to bring about a change in what it is that we expect until we can get to the point when everybody comes to the table at the same level, that the playing field is level, and that all of us can look at each other in our eyes and say, "Yeah, you've had the same opportunity that I have." And until we have that, it's going to be a little bit difficult.
So I don't know, Lyle and Rufus and Jay and Sherry's sister. I don't know if she was like this growing up, but I've certainly enjoyed her in her time at the league, asking the tough questions, making the tough decisions, and what she just said resonated with me. Once someone does get into office, we have to call them. We have to make sure. Somehow we miss this. We get into we'll just let them do what we need to do. I can hear someone like Akani Lindsay telling me, make the tough decision. So I think we have to do more of that. And when you talk about the inclusion piece of it, it's more than just us having a seat at the table. It is us actually moving into action and doing things. So for those of you who have known you for several years, and those of you who have known us only a short time, we thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
We're not done yet.